Welcome to She Is Never Lost, But At Least She Has Wine, a podcast made just for you. Your host is Felicia Stitzel, world traveler and influencer, professional photographer, sommelier, Navy veteran, and mom. Tune in every Thursday for solo episodes where she shares her life story and a wine highlight. Pour yourself a glass and let's dive in.
Hello, 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 and welcome to another food-focused podcast of She's Never Lost, But At Least She Has Wine. Of course, now we are a week into 2022, so I hope that it's already kicking off very good for you. In this podcast, we are going to talk about the six countries that you're going to fall in love with just for the food alone. And trust me, I've got an amazing wine to pair with that. Without further ado, I do have to make a little public service announcement. If you would like to learn more about wine and go through an actual class, I do have my online wine courses that I have. Currently, I have one full course, which is like everything that I have learned from Wine 101 all the way up to my level 2 sommelier. I'm currently in the enthralls of working towards my third level and for my French wine scholar and my Italian wine scholar. Thank God, not all three at once, just two. So obviously, I know a lot about wine. I love to study about wine and learn about wine. And as I'm going through all these tastings and talking to you guys about what wine is and how I'm smelling it and the places where these wines are from and all my other little random notes I tend to throw in, if you find any of this interesting or fascinating and you want to learn more, please check out, there's the link in the show notes to my Basic to Bougie wine course. So like I said, I have my full one and then I have a micro course, which is Learn How to Taste Like a Pro, which is basically just a super breakdown version of how I come to train myself to have the smells and senses like I do when I go through the beginning of these podcasts where I'm talking about the smell and the notes and the flavors and the palate and the body and the texture and all of these really hype words. I explain all of them. I break them all down in the micro course. You could do it in an entire afternoon if you really wanted to get it done, or you can do it step by step. There are several steps to it, but it's something that you can do several times, come back to, get more information, test new things, and then of course, once you're a student, you also have access to basically do Zoom calls and tastings with me. So if that sounds interesting, be sure to check that out in the show notes. There's the link below to my platform for my online wine courses. So now to get to the wine. All right, so I'm starting off 2020 with a bang, y'all. Because when I think of like the big and the bad, the first thing that comes to mind most of the time is Bordeaux. You get the big bad Bordeaux, all my triple B's. And this time though, when most people, I actually did a wine tasting class, private class for a family here in Spain, and they had made the comment about when we got to the Bordeaux white, they're like, I didn't even know that that was a thing. Whenever you hear Bordeaux, people make that connection as always being to red. They only imagine that Bordeaux is a red wine. Well, actually, Bordeaux, not only do they kick butt at red wine, but they kill it at white wine too. This is part of the reason why it's one of the largest export regions in the world, as well as for France. So a Bordeaux blend has to have several different grapes in it, obviously, thus the blend factor. The one that I'm tasting through right now has a Sauvignon Blanc, a Semillon, and a Muscadel. So Muscadel is known in many different countries by many different names, but it's basically like the Muscadel, the Muscat. They all basically sound similar. They just might have an A or an O or a T extra on the end to make it more individual to the country that they're being grown in, but they're all basically the same grape, just grown in different regions. So this is a 2018 white Bordeaux blend, and I am really excited about this because this is one of my, like, I love white Bordeaux. It's mostly, like, I like Sauvignon Blancs by themselves, but they tend to be just a little too acidic for me. I like to have something with a little bit more body to it, a little bit more rounded. And so I love a Semillon, but sometimes a Semillon might be just a little too much of any one thing, depending on where it's grown. So when you have these blends, it's like I actually was just explaining this the other day to somebody where it's like they normally don't like this one grape, but they had it. It was a red blend and it was blended with Merlot. And I was like, well, actually, that makes perfect sense because Merlot is one of those perfect grapes. It's a perfect blending grape. You can drink it all by itself and you can blend it with, I mean, gosh, you could almost blend it with just about any red, theoretically, because I always imagine Merlot as like the kumbaya, like the dude who's sitting at the fireplace singing kumbaya. That's what I imagine when I think of, in my weird brain, that's what I think of when I am talking about and thinking about Merlot. Most of the time, I tend to have like a MMA boxing scenario for most of my analogies, but for Merlot, I just apparently, he's too chill, so he's like the dude who sings kumbaya at a fireplace. All right, so get into the nose. Oh, and see, what I love about a Bordeaux white is because it's so powerful. You get all kinds of crazy flavors. So like here, I have like apple, like green apple and pear and pineapple and like a little citrus on it, like a little lemon zest. Or like when you do a gin and tonic and you put like the orange peel in there, it's like the same thing. But then it's still very dry. So it has like that mineral. Like if you, what comes to mind for me, and of course everybody is different with their olfactory senses and tied to memories, but when I get that kind of really clean, crisp scent, I think about sitting on the edge of a bank of a river, and a river that has like a rock waterbed. And normally like the image that's in my mind is a glacier river because it's very clean. It's very crisp. It's almost like drinking cold, cold water, but then it has that, you know, wine and the acidity and the flavors and the body. So honestly, like that's what comes to mind when I'm smelling this. Oh, and it's so, like I said, it has that acidity factor. Like you can smell that in there, but it's one that it just, oh, it's so good. Oh, and then you taste it. Now, I will say that the first taste of a Bordeaux blend sometimes can be just a little potent. I actually learned a trick from a gentleman who was a beer connoisseur, and he always said, you need to have three sips, always three sips. Because the first one acclimates your palate, the first washes your palate, the second acclimates it, and the third is when you actually taste what it is that you're wanting to taste. So that makes perfect sense because when you first take a sip of wine, it's like your first sip of the day, it's going to be abrupt. It's going to be harsh because your taste buds are really fresh versus if you're going to start tasting wines, you know, five or six bottles later, obviously your taste buds aren't going to be very clean anymore. You've been murdering your taste buds with all of that wine that it can't pick out things anymore. Your taste buds are almost as drunk as you'll be. So that's definitely something that I would recommend taking into effect. Like, don't let sip number one dictate whether or not you actually like this wine. Go through the three sip trial. So that was sip one. And I spent so much time talking about it, I didn't even get any flavors, so I don't remember the flavors. So that one, not as potent. It's not as in your face. So the first sip did have crazy acidity, which is why I went down that rabbit hole. So it hit the back of my jaw with that acidity right away. And then with the second sip, I'm actually getting more of the body and more of the flavors. Still getting that pineapple-y taste as well as green apple. Like, and I always put things into a pastry. I won't do that this time because the pastry is too mild. It's like biting right into a freshly harvested, like right off the tree, green, like a granny green apple. That's what comes to mind because you get that tartness and then you get that fruit. But then after you chew for a little while, it kind of mellows out and goes away. Like it just kind of chills. But then It's almost like you can taste the stone, like that image that I have in my head of sitting next to a glacier river on the rock stone riverbed. Like that's, I can taste that sitting there after like a nice long hike, drinking some water and having a Granny Green Apple for a refreshment. Like that is this wine in a glass. Hope that gives you a good mental picture because I'm actually kind of appreciating that. All right, so now we're going to get into the first story of 2020. Woo! So exciting. All right, so I had to start you guys off good, and that is 6 countries you're going to fall in love with for just the food alone. So for each one of these countries, I do have another blog and a podcast talking about every single one of them individually. Stories, tips, all that kinds of stuff. This one, I am specifically focusing on food because you know what? I know holidays are over and most of us have done all of our binge eating for the entire year. Now all of our resolutions are kicking in, which is always on the list. I'm going to start working out again. I'm going to the gym. I mean, there's only like a 10% chance of people actually follow through with that unless you're crazy disciplined. I am disciplined, but I'm not that disciplined. I will start working out again. Just kidding. No, I'm gonna. Anyways, so 6 countries you're going to fall in just for the food. I know I have talked a lot about travel and travel with kids and family and experiences and tips on how to find the best discount and prices and stuff like that. But for this one, I want to like, I know food and culture are like symbiotic to one another, but this one, like, I'm serious. Like, you're going to need to eat something before finishing the rest of this podcast because it's kind of lengthy and it will make you hungry afterwards. All right. So I'm going to start off with one that is constantly talked about in my home, and that's Fiji. And like I said, my husband and I, we still constantly talk about how much we miss Fijian food. And it's been over 3 years since we took our trip to Fiji. And I still can taste some of that food. You know, obviously Fijian food, they live off the land. They have spent an entire lifetime and hit thousands of years cultivating their menu around what they can get their hands on. So their vegetables are roots. Their main protein is seafood. Their greens is, you know, leaves and seaweed and all these kinds of things. But what the difference is, though, is that they have learned how to do a lot with their food. So it feels like it's like you're being really indulgent whenever you eat their food, but it's like crazy healthy for you. And that's what I love is that, yeah, when you go and you buy at a restaurant, like the fancy foods and stuff, it's really expensive in Fiji because, once again, it's an island. So when you're trying to bring in foods from other countries and other styles and you have to bring in special items and recipes and all that other crap, like those restaurants get really crazy expensive. But when you go to a Fijian restaurant, like it's like an eighth of the cost than anywhere else because it's their food. It's their tradition. They can go out and they can do the farm to table, and they've been doing farm to table for forever. So this is not a new thing here. A lot of the traditional foods include it's takvovia, which is a type of protein. And then you've got taro roots. You got baked or boiled fish, and then seafood in olo, which is coconut cream. Meat here is usually fried and accompanied with the ruru, which is a boiled leaf in lolo, which is the coconut cream. So it's most of the foods are fried or baked, rich, creamy, and absolutely delicious. Like, oh my gosh, I was not kidding when I said that we literally dream about the food that we had in Fiji because it was so delicious. And it was really unexpected. Like, we knew we were going to get good seafood while we were there, but how much good food that we got and taste that we weren't expecting just blows my mind. So if you're a super, super foodie and you have a desire to travel to the South Pacific, you need to hit up Fiji. Trust me, it is amazing. All right, next on my list, which I'm sure everybody is going to appreciate slash maybe roll their eyes a little, is Italy. Obviously, when you think about going to Italy, you always think about pizza, spaghetti, and gelato. Granted, you're not wrong. My husband, when we were on our honeymoon, we did Greece, Italy, and Spain for our honeymoon. A week in each country, 3 weeks total. And, well, let me just say that when I say we ate our way through Italy, we literally ate our way through Italy. He had pizza every single day, at least one time during the entire day, sometimes twice, even three times. I think there was one time where he had it three times because we were walking so much. He got hungry. He would stop. There was like these little pizzeria, basically looking like hot dog stands. And you could go and just buy a slice of pizza or like a little calzone that you could walk around with. And me, well, I ate my way through Italy in gelato. He had his pizza. I had my gelato. He needed to stop for a break. I would stop and get a gelato. And I was totally justified in it because gelato is just slightly healthier. Don't lie to me. I think it's healthy. I'm going to just believe that. Don't burst my bubble. And like I said, we were walking. I mean, we walked almost 10 miles every single day. So needless to say, I had earned my gelato by the end of the day. But Italian food is not just those. Like, those are like the tourist version of Italian cooking. Do Italians, yes, still have spaghetti and gelato and pizza? Absolutely. The spaghetti isn't what you're thinking of with like the spaghetti and meatballs, because that's not traditional. It's the red sauce, the basil leaf, and then the pasta. So don't go to Italy and be asking for the meatballs, because it's not a thing. They make it more of a thing because more people ask for it, but traditionally it's not a thing. If you're looking for more traditional cooking and recipes, then you need to know things like the polenta, which is like a cornmeal porridge. This particular mastermind was actually created in northern Italy, but now you can find it basically throughout the entire country. And you find it with like a ragu style sauce and some cheese. It's delicious. Like, seriously delicious. Or the amazing, warm, comforting food of robilatia. I haven't been speaking Italian for a very long time. My Spanish and my Italian are hating each other in my brain right now. Anyways, this is a Tuscany version of a traditional soup. It's basically, in Italian, it translates to almost scraps food, which means anything can happen, like anything goes. That's recipes like we call in the United States, where they cook everything with they threw in everything and the kitchen sink. That's this recipe. But that's what makes it fun, is because obviously not everyone is going to make it the same. You have a lot of diversity that you can get here, which makes it fun to just kind of taste your way through the robilatita, because it's diverse. It diversifies from what's in season, what season you travel to. And then it diversifies by where you are in the country. So I would recommend definitely trying it at least once, maybe twice, to give yourself some diversity and give yourself a fair chance. And then, of course, it couldn't be talking about foods from Italy if I didn't mention risotto. I love risotto. I have had several different kinds of risotto. Actually, probably one of my favorite ones, which sounds like it would be really weird, is it's a black risotto, which is more indigenous to Croatian food, but you know, Croatia and Italy are basically right next to each other, so it's not really that far stretch that one would had traveled across the Aegean Sea to, you know, Italy, or from Italy over. Of course, most people know what risotto is. It's a short grain rice that's slowly cooked with broth and heat that turns into this rich and creamy, thick, warm sauce. You can add almost anything to it. I've had lots of different versions of risotto, which is also another reason why it becomes so fun, is because, once again, the diversity. Like I said, the black risotto, it was made with squid ink and then pieces of shrimp in it. All right, next on our travel itinerary is Greece. And I'll tell you what, Greece has my heart and my stomach, because the food that I had in Greece kind of ruined me for anywhere else, which is bad because we were going to Italy right after Greece. Of course, Italy stands alone all by itself. It doesn't need to compete with anybody, especially not with Greece. But Greece itself has just something that is so special, and it's called baklava. Obviously, baklava is not actually traditionally from Greece. It's actually traveled with the Romans, who came from everywhere, and then from the Phoenicians. I mean, there's a long, long history behind baklava, which I've learned recently. But this is one of many things that makes the menus in Greece so delicious. I tried making baklava once, and oh my gosh, it was not the same. I didn't have the patience for the thousands and thousands of layers of that puff pastry, because oh my gosh. Ugh, I'll tell you what, that's a struggle. But Greek food has always been very near and dear to me. I grew up with adopted by love siblings that are all Greek. There's 5 of them, which means that when they make dinner, not only is it very loud, but it's delicious. And what's funny is that when the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding came out, I literally looked over at my siblings. My mom and I, we all did this basically. I looked over at my siblings and I was like, oh my God, it's you. Yeah, because it's true. I mean, not to put them in a box, but because they wouldn't fit. They'd be too loud for the box. The food, though, that they always made for us, that was something that was traditional to them, was amazing. So obviously, everybody knows what calamari is. But did you know that it actually, calamari originates, the style of how it's cooked is actually from Greece? I didn't know that for years and years and years. But that is actually one of the great things that has come out of Greece. Other great ones is slavaki or souvlaki, which is a grilled meat on a skewer that can be anything from pork or chicken, lamb, beef, vegetables, if you wanted something grilled, but you're a vegetarian. Another favorite, that one's really good because you can have it as they have basically a tapas version of it where it's much, much smaller. And then they have ones that come with a flatbread and the yogurt sauce and rice. I mean, they have a bunch of things that they get added in with it, so it becomes its own meal. Or they have the little taster ones. Another one of my favorite is moussouka. Oh, moussouka is amazing because this is a very traditional recipe that combines a sauteed eggplant, tomatoes, ground lamb, a layer of potatoes, and then this weird fluffy topping of cheese. It almost, you think about fluffy cheese, I always think about cottage cheese, but it's not that. It's there's not even a word for it. I can picture it in my head, but I can't even think of the word for it right now. Anyways, and then it's topped with a bechamel sauce. So, oh my God, so amazing. And then of course, everybody knows a gyro, or gyro, gyro, however it is that you're trying to pronounce it. That, of course, is an extremely Greek dish. So if you've been living under a rock for a little while or you're not very adventurous with foods, a gyro is made with pork, fries, this tanasaki, which is a sauce, and then tomatoes, cucumbers, and then wrapped up in a pita bread. Oh my God. Amazing. There's a bunch of other ones, and trust me, I could keep going on, but I'm going to digress, and I'm going to move on to the next country, which is Morocco. Oh my God, if I can tell you guys anything about Morocco, it's that I've been twice and I want to keep going back, and I want to go back just to eat. Everything else is amazing, loved it, but I want to go back for the food because every time I think about the two times that I have been to Morocco and the food that I had there, my mouth just waters and you're just oh, take me now. Oh, it's so good because there's so many flavors and they slow cook and they use these very interesting ancient techniques of cooking that make the food flavorful and delicious and just amazing. So one of the traditional ways that they cook is tagine, which isn't actually the food itself. You can get a tagine anything. The tagine is actually the container. It's the pot that they cook it in. It's this clay, almost pyramid-looking thing. Anyway, it's an earthware pot that it's cooked in, and there's vegetables and meats and spices, and they put it all together, and then they make this amazing, amazing meal which is then served in tagine. And then, of course, be ready for the fruit. Every single meal that I had there, there was fruit. There was fruits of all different kinds. There was colorful arrangements. It was fantastic. And what I like, though, is that, like, it gives you that diversity on the table. Not only does it make the table really, really pretty, but maybe the meat was too spicy, too rich, too whatever, and you need something to cut that. And so then you've got this plate of, you know, fruit that's sitting next to you, where you have grapes and mangoes and kiwis and strawberries and all these other different kinds of fruit that they already have arranged so beautifully for you. And then it just makes for a really pretty table too. One of the favorite things that I picked up from Morocco, and then I actually have tried making this, and it actually worked. It wasn't as pretty as theirs, but it worked, which is all that really matters, which is called messimen. It's a bread. It's a flatbread. It's like a pita or naan, but to me it's better. Like, you serve it slightly warmed and with cream cheese, and they have that with breakfast or with, like, honey and fruits or meats, or, like, oh my God, so good. I, like, now I'm thinking, how long would it take me to make that again? Because last time it took me a while, and we were in lockdown, and I had nowhere to go. So now I'm like, Now I want to make it again. Once again, if you are a lover of food, you definitely need to go and check out Morocco. It's Morocco. Like, there's not much more you can say that would really do it justice. Like, it's just Morocco. All right, next is Israel. I would say that if you're a lover of hummus, then you're going to love Israel. Like, top of the line. Many people think that hummus, it was invented in Israel. Any country who has hummus is going to debate you on that, because they all believe that they invented it or they came up with it. But hummus is actually, like, the perfect example as to how Israel is, which is a mixing pot. There's all these different histories, cultures, religions, styles of food, all of those things that came from ancient times all the way up until now. And they all got kind of blended together to become what is Israel. And I think that hummus is actually a perfect representation to what Israel is, which is also creamy and delicious and amazing and makes you want more. So that's also Israel. I've been twice and I'm dying to go back. If you wanted to taste all of the list of, like, top original foods that are from Israel, you are going to need a lot of time there. Like, I literally have an entire recipe book for Israeli food, and it's very thick. It's one of my thickest cookbooks. It's very, very thick. But the food is totally, oh my gosh, it's so good. One of the traditional things that you'll get there is a levantine spread, which is normally, like, mashed chickpeas, and sometimes there's, like, hummus in there, and the beans are blended with tahini and olive juice or lemon juice and olive oil, salt and a little garlic, and then you put that, like, with bread or vegetables and stuff like that. A next one that you have to try are falafels. Oh my gosh, I love me some falafels. But this is a very Middle Eastern dish. You do see falafels in a lot of Middle Eastern places. Like, I even saw them in Morocco and a lot of other places. Jordan had them too. So, and Turkey actually, I think, had them as well. So I'm not going to go into the long history about where falafels came from. If you're in Israel, try them. That's all I'm going to say. Just try them. These are, if you don't know what falafels are, it's actually deep fried chickpeas, flava beans, or both. It might be blended of both. And then normally the falafel is wrapped in, like, a pita sandwich, or it's eaten alone. Depends on the kind of place that you're dining at. And then, of course, believe it or not, one of the top things that you're going to find almost with any meal at a decent restaurant in Israel is salad. I know. You wouldn't think that I would be like, oh my God, go to Israel for the salad. But seriously, like, this salad is, if I'm talking about it, it stuck with me, because I haven't been to Israel since 2014. And yeah, that's a long time ago. And I'm still talking about it. So it has 5 ingredients in it, and it makes it light and zesty. They normally have, like, spinach and olive oil and tomatoes and strawberries and, of course, chickpeas, because chickpeas are in, like, everything. Anyways, if you go to Israel, trust me, get the Israeli salad. It's amazing. Depends on who does it. It kind of looks like it'd be like pico de gallo, but it's not. And it tastes way better. It's very refreshing and kind of filling, especially if you put it on pita bread like I always do. One of my best memories about when I was first introduced to Israeli food is challah bread. I have a lot of memories tied to challah bread. My grandmother, who wasn't biologically my grandmother, she kind of adopted us after my mom's bio parents passed away at a very young age. So she adopted us into the family. Like, I never really knew my real grandparents, but she was always my grandmother, my grandfather. I always had them. And they were Jewish. And so every year we would make challah bread together, especially around Hanukkah. And it was around the holiday season. And every single major Israeli holiday, well, most of them, we made challah bread. And now I still make challah bread in memory of my grandmom. And so to me, this is a very, very special, special bread. But it's also freaking delicious. Like, it looks like the braid that Rapunzel has in the cartoon. But it tastes so good. It's light and fluffy and buttery. That's just slightly crisp on the outside and ooey, like gooey on the inside. It's amazing. And then, of course, the big finale is lox. Now, lox in Yiddish actually means salmon, so be prepared for that. But it's a very, very popular Jewish food, and lox actually refers to the cured, the salt-cured salmon on a bagel with cream cheese. Now, you might be thinking, like, this might be like a bagel you'd get like in the Bronx. And funny enough, that's exactly what you get in the Bronx and most places in New York, because there are a lot of Jewish communities in New York, and it seems to always just kind of be symbiotic now to New York and bagels. So normally is also traditionally served with like tomatoes and cucumbers, onions and capers. So I just, oh my gosh. Trust me, just try it. This is like, you're going to have a long list of things where it's like, if you go to these countries, you'd be like, trust me, just try it. So during my last podcast, I did touch on Vietnam just a little bit, but I am going to touch on it now again because it was so good. So if you listen to last podcast, you kind of know the backstory a little bit. Traveled with my dad and my daughter. She turned 11 months there, so she was baby. And the food. Oh my God, the food. The first food I'm actually going to highlight in this one is the white rose dumpling. This is a local dish that you can find from Hoi An, and it is delicious. It's a translucent kind of white dough with a spicy mint shrimp or pork that's steamed lightly into the dumpling. I'm sorry, but that by itself means I need another drink of wine because it sounds so good that it makes me hungry. Oh, so good. Anyway, so if that doesn't get you going, how I normally start my day is coffee. And so if you guys are like me, you're going to want some coffee. So you need to know how to order the coffee or what is that you're looking for. In Vietnam, I tried my very first egg coffee. Sounds really weird, trust me, but it's delicious. It's from Hanoi, and I know, Hoi An and then Hanoi, it gets confusing. But it's really sweet and very delicious. They have, and forgive me on the translation on this or my how I'm speaking it, but they have a Cai Pen Trinh, which is a rich Vietnamese coffee base with this frothy egg yolk and condensed milk on top of it. Oh, so good. I have never had coffee like that anywhere else. I've tried recreating it myself. I even bought the little coffee thing that they made, which is like the slow dripper that they put on top of your cup. I even bought one of those to take home with me. I got the Vietnamese coffee to bring home and try it, and I still cannot make it right. I cannot tell you how many YouTube videos I have watched trying to make this same thing and replicate it, and it never works. Never works, which makes me sad. But, all right, so next on the Vietnamese list that if you guys are adventurous, especially with Asian food, you'll know, but it's Pho, which is P-H-O, Pho. Basically, this is a poor man's dish because it's a little bit of noodles with broth, and it has rice noodles and bony broth and herbs. And then some people add meats in there. But obviously, like, this was, it was traditionally made for breakfast, and it was made normally the night before. So that way you could just heat it up and then start your day. The lack of ingredients can tell you about the economic level of families who were eating this traditionally. But it's, even though it's a very, very basic meal, it's actually really good, and you can do a lot with it. So, of course, throughout the years, it's become more adventurous. People are trying new things. They're trying to recreate an old menu, and they're trying to diversify it and to make it something new to bring back tradition. So needless to say, there's a lot you can do with something so simple. The last one that I want to highlight for Vietnam is Banoik. Is B-A-N-H-X-E-O. I apologize. Once again, it's a struggle. Translations are a struggle. But I tasted this dish for the first time when we were in Hue, and it's amazing. It's actually a street food that you can find, and it's this crispy bacon. It's like a savory bacon. The batter is made of this rice flour and coconut milk and turmeric, and then it's filled with pork strips or shrimp or bean sprouts, spring onion, and then fried. Or it could be a combination of all those things. Trust me, I've done it, and it was really good. Definitely one thing to know before ordering. There's only one way to eat this, and it's kind of this tradition, and that is you place the piece of it on the rice paper roll and then add fresh vegetables, dip it into a sauce, and then take a bite. You have to do this after every bite, apparently. If you don't do that correctly, then they might look at you funky, or you can just suck it up and be like, I'm a tourist, and then not care. So these are just six of the countries that I have traveled to where the food was amazing and has left my mouth watering, wanting more. So if you want to check these back out again, I will attach the link to the blog in the show notes, and you can check them out again. Get the actual proper translation for some of these, because I'm sorry. I'm not great at this translation thing. I will get better one day, but until then, it'll be okay. So I hope you enjoyed this. You know, traveling to me is all about enjoying the history, the culture, and truly experiencing the people. And what the people and the culture and the history all are tied to is the food. So if you want to get all three of those in one easy way, just go eat locally. So be sure to tune in and subscribe to the podcast on any podcast platform that you listen to. This is almost on basically all of them. So be sure to hit the subscribe button for more tips, tricks, foodie, wine, and more. Cheers, you guys.